Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
A wild week on Wall Street, health insurance Walmart style, and escaping it all in a movie about escaping it all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Good Friday, the start of Passover, and Cesar Chavez Day is observed today. All of that is also known as March 30th. Thanks for joining us. Let's begin with the weekly wrap. Joining me are Neela Richardson, chief economist at Redfin, and Don Lee, economics reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Hey there.
Hi, Molly.
Hi, Molly.
So we're going to start with that wild week on Wall Street. We had yet another tariff scare. A big drop. Don, what's kind of going on with this market volatility related to these tariff fears?
Well, you know, as we know, last week, President Trump announced tariffs of 50 to 60 billion on Chinese goods. And of course, people are concerned that this will trigger a trade war with our biggest trading partner and the world's second largest economy. Mm-hmm. And so investors, of course, are nervous. And then on top of that, you have interest rates that are rising and could crimp the housing market a bit and make borrowing costs more expensive. And so I think those are the factors that are that have really enhanced volatility in this first quarter.
And Neela, what do you think about this kind of level of fear and the trade war concerns and this market volatility?
You know what? The market has been really passive. Frankly, the last 3 years, they've been lulled asleep by subsidized interest rates by the Federal Reserve. And so right now, what we're seeing is an awakening. We're seeing interest rates again creep up, as was just said, but we're also seeing the market react to policy change. And it is a sea change in policy, going from a very pro-free trade stance of previous administrations to tariffs on steel and lumber and maybe a host of other goods. And the market is trying to figure out what that means down the road. So we're seeing a market that's now reactive instead of passive. And I think we can expect that for some time to come.
And then, of course, the other thing we saw this week that dragged down markets was Facebook and concerns over tech stocks. Setting aside the question of whether tech stocks are overrepresented at this point in terms of their power, let's talk about Facebook and everything data related that has been kind of tanking this week as these revelations continue to come out about data harvesting. Neela, do you feel like this is a turning point for consumer privacy?
I hope so. You know, we've been trading privacy for convenience for a long time now without really thinking through the repercussions of what it meant. And really, Facebook's model is pretty old. I mean, newspapers have been doing it for a long time, selling ads. The difference is the consumer is the product and the consumer data is monetized. And so while we don't know, you know, we can see Facebook's profits and their revenues, we don't know how many consumers are actually leaving Facebook as a result of the scandal. We know that the market value has changed dramatically, even just this week, but we don't know what the consumer reaction is going to be. And that probably won't be known for several weeks and months down the road. But it's time to start that discussion now about what data privacy means and how we can make it safe in the future.
And Don, I know you primarily cover international trade, and I just wonder what you think. This might be a curveball for you, but what do you think about this idea of data as an international product? You know, it's regulated very differently in Europe than it is here. Some have argued that some of those European regulations could be a blueprint for what's going on here. But when you look at the way data crosses borders, what comes to mind for you?
I think the fact that that data users and governments that want to protect their citizens are going to have to grapple with the fact that their data users are everywhere. And so it is international, and we do have data and these companies that operate internationally. So I do think that you're going to have to set up some sort of global standards that will be acceptable and that will be followed and that will cross borders. I think some of the trade agreements have actually attempted to to do so, and we'll see how that goes.
And Nila, just about 30 seconds left. Do you think that there's too much reliance on tech stocks and the major indices? That was sort of bantered about this week as well.
Too much is hard. There's certainly a lot. About 25% of the S&P is tied to tech. So this is, again, a fundamental change where the S&P was driven by automobiles and industry like steel. Now it's like streaming and social media. So it is a shift. And they do have, tech stocks do have an outsized role now in our stock market valuation overall. And if they're under siege, then people might start feeling that in their 401k. Case. Yeah. So again, it's an industry that's not regulated. And so where goes tech now, so goes our investments overall.
Nila Richardson at Redfin and Don Lee from the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Molly.
On Wall Street, shares of Under Armour slid yesterday after the company revealed that hackers broke into about 150 million user accounts back in February. Markets are closed today for the Easter holiday. We will have some other sweet details when we do the numbers. Now to the biggest business story of the week. Walmart is looking to make what could be its biggest deal yet. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which reports that the retail behemoth is in early stage talks to buy Humana, the health insurer with a market value sitting at $37 billion. If the deal is approved by regulators, it would be the latest in a series of major merger attempts in the healthcare industry. Think CVS and Aetna, Cigna and Express Scripts. Marketplace's Rima Grace reports on what the potential deal could mean for Walmart.
There's a big push in the healthcare industry right now to make things more customer-centric. Robert Field, a health policy professor at Drexel University, says a deal between Walmart and Humana could help do that.
I think it means that you will find healthcare shopping as easy as buying a TV or a box of Cheerios. I think that's the vision that they have.
Most of Walmart's roughly 4,700 stores already have pharmacies in them. Some even have primary care clinics. Field says this kind of deal would give Walmart more data, more opportunity to cut costs and streamline its health services to customers who may be looking elsewhere.
Walmart is more and more aware of Amazon creeping up behind them and threatening their model.
But more than that, this deal could help deepen the retailer's relationship with a crucial demographic, says Anna Gupte, an analyst at Leerink Partners.
The deal is really about the 55 million plus American senior market.
Humana, which already partners with Walmart, has a big stake in the Medicare Advantage market with about 3.5 million participants.
Walmart should be able to drive more seniors and foot traffic in store with a deal like this.
First, the deal needs to actually happen, says Amanda Stark, a professor of strategy at Northwestern University.
These sort of large acquisitions are hard to pull off well, and they're especially hard to pull off well in healthcare.
She says any deal would have to get the green light from antitrust regulators to make sure this marriage of big retail and big insurance doesn't hurt consumers. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
And the 2020 census was back in the news this week after the Trump administration said it would add a question about citizenship for the first time since 1950. Democratic members of Congress are trying to stop that. So are several states that have filed lawsuits. The concern is that the question will scare people off and lead to an undercount. It wasn't that long ago that the biggest problem facing the census was money after years of being chronically underfunded. This year's spending bill has thrown the census a big chunk of cash, but that may not be enough to keep the once-in-a-decade population count on track. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
The spending bill includes $2.8 billion to get ready for the census, nearly double last year's amount. And not a moment too soon, says Jennifer Van Hook, a professor of demography at Penn State.
Because of the sheer amount of time it takes just to conduct a census with over 300 million people. And so the chronic underfunding does raise concerns.
And Van Hook says that chronic underfunding has already had an effect, like canceled field tests of new questions and technology. Indever Duttagupta is with the Georgetown Center for Poverty and Inequality.
Essentially attempts to test out new strategies, especially since this will be the first census with a robust online option for responses, have had to be cut back, and that raises some serious worries.
And the citizenship question has been added so late in the process, there's not really much time to test it. So nobody really knows, for instance, whether undocumented or even legal immigrants won't participate.
The risk would be, though, if the question results in a decline in self-response.
John Thompson was the director of the Census Bureau from 2013 until last year. If people don't respond, the government will need to send more people out to follow up, and that costs money.
So if for example, the self-response was to drop from 60% to 59%, that's a 1% drop. That would cost $55 million more.
And if people still don't trust the government enough to respond, they risk not being counted at all, which has a whole different set of costs. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
From the all-too-real world to the fantasy world, the movie Ready Player One opens in theaters this weekend to high expectations from the many fans of the best-selling novel. It's set in the year 2045, in a version of the future where people spend more time in a virtual world called the Oasis than they do in the real world. The film is nostalgic gold for fans of video games and 80s movies, and it is fittingly directed by Steven Spielberg. Ernest Cline wrote the book and co-wrote the screenplay. I sat down with him and I asked if he really thinks we'll ever spend all our time in virtual reality.
Yes, I do, you know, and I think it's actually happening a lot more quickly than I predicted in my novel. You know, in my mind, it seems like the inevitable end of the evolution of video games. Computer simulation goes from, you know, as rudimentary as we can create when we first invent it to, you know, becoming photorealistic and indistinguishable from reality. There's nowhere else for it to evolve. So I think that's where we're headed. And it seems to be, you know, happening extremely fast.
That's funny, because I was going to ask if you thought it would take until 2045 to get that good. But do you think even since 2011 or so to now?
Yeah, you know, strangely, and not to be self-aggrandizing, but it seems like in some ways Ready Player One is becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy because of the publication of the novel. You know, right at the time that it came out was the same summer that Oculus Rift was invented and that company was founded. And because of that, you know, as soon as my novel was published, it was immediately recommended to everybody who was working in virtual reality at the time. And then, you know, they've since told me that they still give out copies of the novel to everyone who comes to work at Oculus as inspiration to work in virtual reality, which is really, really flattering. But also, I think just a part of it is luck and timing in that I wrote this novel imagining virtual reality right at the moment when our technology finally caught up with the idea.
Yeah, the movie certainly has more of a message, I think, about unplugging, the importance of the real world and of disconnecting. And that we're in the middle of a conversation about, you know, sort of tech addiction and going too far. Was that deliberate?
Yes. You know, it is a theme that's explored in the novel. You know, the last line of the novel is about unplugging and the protagonist kind of realizing that reality is the only place you can find true happiness because reality is real. And I don't think the internet is a bad thing. And I'm fascinated by the way in which it's a communication tool, right? You know, but we oftentimes use it as a way to not communicate to the people who are right around us. You have to find a balance in your life between fantasy and reality because both are necessary elements of being a happy person.
I know there was an Easter egg in the book Ready Player One. Easter eggs is like the whole point of this entire thing. Is there an Easter egg in the movie?
There are a few million Easter eggs in this movie.
Not just the ones I get to look for and pause and, you know, I mean, the secret kind.
You know, I don't even know all the Easter eggs in this movie. Steven doesn't either, you know, because ILM and Digital Domain, who did the Oasis and the real world special effects, respectively, they each snuck Easter eggs in without telling us. And Steven, you know, only spotted a few of them at the last minute. So I think once the Blu-ray comes out, we're all going to be going through it frame by frame to find all the Easter eggs. But I don't know if any of these Easter eggs will lead you to fame and fortune.
Ernest Cline is author of the book Ready Player One and one of the screenwriters on the new movie. Ernest, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. I enjoyed speaking with you.
coming up.
And I think that attitude toward risk is probably more distinctive in California than just about anywhere else in the United States.
Welcome to the Risk Takers Club. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets are closed for Good Friday today, and tonight is the first night of Passover, so let's look at holiday-related numbers. The National Retail Federation predicts Easter spending will total more than $18 billion this year. Candy tops the list of anticipated purchases, of course, along with other foods, gifts, Easter clothes, and greeting cards. In the candy aisle, it is the height of Peeps season, as you probably know. The company that makes them, Just Born Quality Confections, is in an ongoing labor dispute, though, over enrolling new employees in pension plans funded by multiple employers. Just Born produces 5.5 million peeps per day, or 2 billion per year. Don't worry, though, they only have about 28 calories each. On the Passover front, the publication Kosher Today writes that an estimated 55,000 items were certified kosher for the upcoming holiday. That is more than double the number of kosher items for the holiday back in 2005. You are listening to Marketplace.
Hey, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
And we are back with our podcast, Make Me Smart, asking people the question that never fails to get a great answer.
I would say,
eventually.
What is something that you thought you knew and then later found out you were wrong about? Take a moment, take a breath, think about it.
It's going to take a while.
Tell us your answers.
Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. At 6 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesday night, over 2 million people stopped what they were doing to play this.
Hi, everybody. I am live from New York City, and this is HQ, a trivia game show on your phone where you answer tough questions to win real money.
The mobile quiz app called HQ Trivia has generated a ton of buzz since it launched last year. It's part of a wave of mobile trivia games with cash prizes for winners. Those prizes are usually small and split between multiple winners. Wednesday's sponsored $250,000 prize, though, marked HQ's biggest game ever. But we wondered, who's playing these trivia games, and are they winning real money? Neil Pollack is the trivia expert to ask. In his case, it's a yes. He's a freelance writer, a three-time Jeopardy champion, and he recently won $25,000 playing trivia on his phone. Neil, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Neil, let's talk about this sort of landscape, this mobile trivia app landscape. How many of them are out there that you know of or that you play?
Well, I regularly play two or three, but I know of at least a half dozen others that are out there. I mean, once HQ debuted, suddenly there was money being offered every day, all day. And in the past, if you wanted to win money playing trivia, you had to either get on Jeopardy or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And those are, I can tell you that those are both laborious processes. So the fact that there's this constant stream of money being offered, even in small increments, which is usually what you win in these apps, is a huge change.
Hmm. And are people excited about it? Are trivia enthusiasts like yourself excited about it?
I think I'm probably more excited about it than most people. But 2.3 million people played Wednesday night. So, you know, it's definitely a whole new generation of trivia fans being created by these, because I think a lot of the players are young.
Right. You also got that big dopamine hit, though, because you won $25,000 on an app at South by Southwest. Can you tell us about that? That was not HQ Trivia, right? What app was that?
No, I won $25,000 on an app called Prove It, which is a slightly different model. you bet money against other players. And they had a contest in Austin, and I won. They awarded me $25,000. So yeah, of course I'm enthusiastic about this. I mean, it's a profitable hobby all of a sudden.
Yeah. Is there also a sense that it's going to be profitable for these mobile apps? Like, do you have any sense of how these companies are going to make money and how that might change them going forward?
Well, there are different models. I mean, Prove It, which is the app that I won, takes a rake, just like online poker companies do. So if I bet a dollar and the person against me bets a dollar, the app takes some 24-cent rake or whatnot. So, you know, if there are thousands and thousands of games playing per day, then suddenly that turns into a legitimate money-making model. In the case of HQ, the key is obviously going to be advertising and sponsorship. I mean, the jackpot on Wednesday night was actually sponsored by Warner Brothers. It was a promotional stunt for Ready Player One. You know, and they had a quiz the night before, or a couple days before, where they gave away $100,000 courtesy of Nike.
Right.
So I think corporations are seeing that there's an audience for this, and so they're investing in it.
Is there any kind of like trivia purist backbone that's going to get raised as the questions start to get more promotional, like their placements for, you know, Nike shoes or movies?
Oh, I'm sure there are going to be some trivia purists who think it's beneath them to play a Ready Player One quiz, or I don't know, a quiz sponsored by Carl's Jr. or whoever is going to sponsor them. But the way I look at it is this is money that's being given away. And so if there's a Carl's Jr. quiz, then I'm going to study up on the names of Carl's Jr. burgers for a few hours before, or a few minutes before playing. I don't think in a few hours. I don't think you'd need a few hours on that. But yeah, I mean, you can be a purist if you want, but you know, when Jeopardy gives out prize money, it doesn't come out of Alex Trebek's pocket. It comes from advertisers. A win's a win, as far as I'm concerned.
Neil Pollack, satirist, novelist, columnist, and trivia champion. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
All those crazy entrepreneurs hoping to make a buck with trivia apps and other startups are straight out of the California playbook. This state has always been a place for people to come, take a risk, and find their fortune, whether it was looking for streams full of gold or hoping for big splashy IPOs and stock payouts. KPCC's David Wagner reports on how California embraced risk and became the world's sixth largest economy.
This former rave warehouse in downtown LA doesn't seem like an obvious place to start a company. The blacklight paint and dungeon doors don't scream office environment. But Joe Fernandez says it's a great home for his startup.
It was actually the only place we looked at.
His company, Joy Mode, rents fun stuff to people who don't want to own it. Camping gear, movie projectors, giant Jenga blocks. Fernandez grew up in Las Vegas and went to college in Miami.
I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to build big things. And it was almost inconceivable to me that you could do that anywhere but California.
He started a company in New York, but says he felt more pressure to turn a profit fast. To him, California feels like a better place to find support for a
really audacious, crazy, like likely to fail idea. And I think this is like the only place you could do that.
And the numbers show that this kind of risk-taking is common here. One measure of entrepreneurship compiled by a Kansas City nonprofit that encourages entrepreneurship is called the Kauffman Index. It puts California in the number one spot for startup activity among larger states. And the Milken Institute's Kevin Clowden notes that California leads the country in terms of venture capital investment as a percent of state GDP.
There are more chances being taken per capita in California in terms of the kind of investments being done than any other state.
That culture of risk-taking goes all the way back to California's gold rush. In 1848, a sawmill worker discovered gold along the American River near Sacramento. Over the next decade, more than 300,000 people rushed to California, many hoping to get rich quick. Most didn't. But the gold rush helped create the state's early economic backbone. University of Texas Austin historian H.W. Brand says it also created a new mindset.
The idea that failure could be almost a prerequisite for success. You had to be willing to take those risks. Sank roots very early in the California consciousness.
Brand says Americans tended to see success and failure as a sign of character.
So that if one failed, in the East, one had to look inside to ask, what's wrong with me?
But for those early miners in California, success and failure were really just about luck.
And I think that that attitude toward risk is probably more distinctive in California than just about anywhere else in the United States.
Nationwide, the U.S. Census finds that smaller, younger companies are responsible for 27% of job creation. JoyMode co-founder Joe Fernandez says California has its drawbacks. Taxes are high, it's expensive, but
there's also more energy and there's also more opportunity. And to me, that feels well worth the benefits.
At this point, he can't imagine building a company anywhere else. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner for Marketplace.
That story is part of a statewide journalism collaboration looking at the California dream. You can find more at kpcc.org. This final note before we go, a judge has ruled that Starbucks and 90 other coffee companies have to put cancer warnings on their cups in California. The ruling is in response to a 2010 lawsuit over a chemical that, in large amounts, has been shown to cause cancer. The National Coffee Association says the amount of chemical found in coffee is small enough to be harmless, said it is considering appeals, and said studies have actually shown coffee to be healthy. I'm just saying, if those warnings show up, I'm going to quietly cover them with my coffee cup sleeve. What? I want my coffee. All right, we got to go. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I am Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. Don't worry, he'll be back next week. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.